TSN1200.ca, and he joins us on that Gabriel Pizza Hotline. Good morning, Eric. How are you?
The last segment of the week, saving the worst for last. The show airs bi-weekly, Wednesdays, and then re-airs Saturdays. But as I said, I simply cannot tolerate a full re-airing of the show for Wednesdays, so I often go in and change it and make things miserable for the producers by emailing them a copy of the new segment and saying, please swap it out on the servers, because the show airs in various cities, obviously. Well, obviously,
will you be doing that for this weekend?
Yes, hey, absolutely.
You're doing that for this weekend?
I am. I do it now. I do it for every weekend only because I typically do it for one of the segments. It's because this discussion on the NHL and where the PA and the league are, while nothing has changed in 2 days, the conversation and the questions and the issues continue to evolve, and it's important that when a show airs, that it reflect where that conversation is. Fair? I think so.
Absolutely. And to that point, Eric, from your stance, I saw your tweet there yesterday. Where do you see the situation between the PA and the NHL right now?
You know, it is a difficult thing, Simmer, and I understand why the players feel betrayed. That's the report. They feel undermined. In any relationship, trust is paramount. And when it feels as though that trust has been betrayed, being in a personal relationship or a business relationship, it can be tough to recover from that. And the NHL signed this CBA with the NHLPA. It was ratified 4 months ago. And once you sign a collective bargaining agreement, that crystallizes the terms and conditions that govern that relationship, in this case, for the next 6 years. And you can't go back on that. And that CBA, in part, provides for these economic modifications and amendments made to this relationship in light of the pandemic, the escrow, the deferral of salaries, all that kind of stuff. So the league signed it. Bettman signed it. The Beer and the players signed the CBA, and now the NHL is saying, look, I know it's been 4 months, but we want to reopen that. We want to open this up again. That's a huge issue. It's a significant issue, especially for the lawyers, you know, for the NHLPA, because they know, as a fundamental principle, you can't do that. But to do that, for Gary Bettman to have the moxie and the guts, this is a huge deal, and he's a lawyer too. He understands that to go to the union and say, look, we need to make changes to this agreement we signed 200 days ago or 150 days ago or whatever it is. Take Scott. So what you need something new and material that has so significantly materially altered the conditions of this relationship that it's no longer feasible to proceed in the manner that was initially negotiated. What's that new thing? Well, you may not see it as a new thing, but it's the league realizing, wait a minute, we made a huge mistake. We're likely going to have no fans in the stands. A lot of businesses, a lot of the leagues and teams believed that fans would be back in their seats and back in stadiums and arenas this coming season. That seems to be highly unlikely. It's not going to happen, at least in Canada. You're not going to have any gatherings. In the U.S., you may have some states, cities, and counties that allow fans in the arenas, but it seems like the league has realized, wait a minute, even our most bleak forecasts didn't account for what is likely now going to transpire, and that's no fans in the seats. So then you look at the math. The players and the league share revenue at a 50-50 clip, right? So last year, revenue was about $4 billion, cap 81.5. That was the revenue sharing arrangement. Well, here, if you do the math, and this is what people are doing, do the math, sit down. If there are no fans in the seats, the media deal is going to generate about $1.6 billion in revenue for the league. That's less than half of last year. So that means that the players, if they stick to the existing arrangement, they're going to be getting about 72% of league revenue. That's not 50%. So that's the problem. They're saying, look, it's not even like it was. Yeah, we screwed up, but we need to fix it. That's the issue.
Well, one of the latest proposals that we last heard was they wanted to add another 13% of deferred salary. So escrow is capped for the upcoming season at 20, and that when you start to do the math on that, so you're still going to get 80% if you're a player with the new offer. Eventually, the salary is going to be deferred, but you're going to get, so 80 is more than some of the numbers you just threw out there as well, Eric. So what is the end game for the players in all this? Is litigation a possibility from the association?
It is. Okay. See, because the league, and this is a great question, and because the league and the union ratified or signed off on the CBA, the league, the union has an argument that if the NHL suspends the season, because they have that right under the standard player contract, it provides expressly the league can suspend the season if there are conditions outside of its control, a force majeure of which a pandemic is. So at first bet, the league has the right to suspend the season. The issue is they've signed the CBA, and the league is effectively saying, unless you change the terms of that CBA, we're going to suspend the season. At law, that would look like a lockout rather than a suspension. And why is that important? Because the CBA, at Article 7, provides the league cannot lock out the players during the term of a CBA. So if the league suspends play, then they open themselves up to liability, and litigation becomes a real possibility.
Eric, when you look back to the original deal getting done, I was shocked at how quickly it happened. I looked at this and thought exactly, hey, at only 20% escrow cap, the risk to the owners is far greater and their losses based on the percentage. Do you think at that time that Gary Bettman, he works for the other owners, ended up making a big mistake by only covering the players at 20% and exposing his owners?
You know, there was talk of the NBA that escrow, because the NBA has escrow as well, it's not just the NHL, was the number floated around there was about 40%, which made more sense to me because that took into account the significant drop in revenue associated with no fans in the seat. So the NHL is a gate-driven league, we know that. You often hear about 50% of revenue is generated by way of ticket sales, but what people forget to talk about is the additional revenue that's generated around the ticket sales, hot dogs, $45 beers, T-shirts, jerseys, parking, the whole thing, right? And that's resulting in a significant financial shortfall for the league. So did Gary Bettman make a mistake? I don't know if he made a mistake, because the league had very good people on its side forecasting the upcoming season. It's just a lot of businesses ask around. They didn't anticipate that there'd be no fans in the seats for 2021. That's the issue.
Yeah.
And so if the players, Sean, if the players get the compensation that they feel they're deserved under the current CBA, they would get $1.6 billion in salary. That's more, far more than half of league revenue, which may be projected to be $2 billion.
Yeah. Yeah, and also to that, Eric, you do the calculation. One of the big things, as you said, there was no trust in the past, and this is more previous to 2004, where guys are hiding revenue, they don't understand it. I would think that the players, through the association, and would you agree, there would not be an ownership group in the National Hockey League under any circumstances without fans that would not take a loss, right? Like, there's nobody, oh, I'm pretending that I'm going to, hey, there's not a, of the 31 teams, there's nobody that's going to make money and a lot that'll lose a whole lot without fans.
Totally. I think this is a circumstance, however unique it is, it's a circumstance where some teams may be okay with a loss. It's the extent of that loss.
Yeah.
And I think that teams are saying, look, we're okay to lose money. Understand that, Don Fear and players. We're going to lose money here. But my goodness, could you help us lose less? Yeah, we made a mistake on our projections and our forecasting. Because if there are no fans in the building, Simmer, that could be $1 billion less in revenue based upon their initial projections. Those aren't even full rinks filled with fans. So, I totally agree with you.
One of the things that's been thrown out there and how the NHL and all sports can recover in the coming years, because it will take years to fully recover from what's going on here with COVID-19, is the influx of legalized betting. And interesting that the Liberal government tabled legislation again yesterday, because they tried a few years ago, didn't work. Tried yesterday tabling it again to bring in single game betting. So none of the parlay stuff that we've seen with ProLine over the years, and trying to bring that in. So how significant is that, Eric, if it gets passed for, you know, professional sports teams in this country, if that gets passed?
It is significant, most significant for the NHL. Agreed. I know that's what you're suggesting. And this is just a matter of time. So we saw more recently in the U.S., the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a law prohibiting states passing their own gambling as unconstitutional, or their own gambling laws, excuse me. And that has resulted in various states, close to 30 already, passing their own gambling laws. And every state will do it. And then in a few years, it's going to be federal in the U.S., and leagues will be getting a kickback off that legislation. In Canada, you know, you mentioned the parlay betting. That is placing multiple bets on bets on multiple games at once, and you can't bet on a single game. And that's just going to change. It's going to change because the provinces recognize that there is a significant opportunity to generate tax dollars. off of this kind of stuff. And it's no longer the case, I think, guys, where gambling is seen as sort of associated with, you know, a seedy kind of underbelly of society. If it's out in the open, it's what Adam Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, said so many times. If gambling is out in the open, perhaps it makes it less likely that it's going to result in corruption, going to result in players throwing games, all those kinds of things. And so it needs to be out in the open. And the financial benefit, Steve, as you and I say many times, the answer to all your questions is money. This is going to be legal because the benefit is just so, so significant for the country.
And I think people behind the scenes, Eric, would be shocked. And I know here in Canada, working with the Leafs, how much the RCMP is involved in monitoring any large cash that's going anywhere to stay on top of it. Now, to that, and you've been on top of this for years, way ahead of the game, the part I've never really been able to figure out, let's just deal with the Canadian side. I would say percentage-wise, because hockey's more popular here, the bets that could be taken in or made here in Canada for the seven teams, how do you regulate that if you're the National Hockey League? And from the provincial and federal governments, how do you, at the end of the day, like, how does a team, I guess, get a piece of the action? Like, we've always seen this being legal. Mm-hmm. What I've never really been able to figure out, you almost as a league, to some extent, either partnership with government or bring it in-house, right? Versus, you know, because the casinos in Vegas, for the majority, other than a little bit of sponsorship, none of the leagues that I understand are really getting a piece of the action, are they?
Yeah, that is the billion-dollar question, literally, because we know in the U.S. alone, you're looking at between $400 and $700 billion is bet on sports every year. And that's why Mark Cuban, the owner of the Mavericks, said that when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down that legislation as unconstitutional, opening up this window for states to pass their own legislation on gambling, he thought that this was going to double franchise valuations. And in theory, it could, but the issue you raise is really important. Because you can bet on Montreal versus Toronto through OLG, for example. You're not using the Canadiens trademark. You're not using the Maple Leafs trademark. You're just using generic names of cities so the teams don't get any money. That's kind of what you're getting at. So there's two things. The first thing is leagues are trying to kind of get their full team names into betting, use of logos. You can't use a third-party logo without permission, licensing all that stuff out. That's the first thing. The second thing is what Adam Silver has talked about for years, beginning with his op-ed piece in New York Times 4 years ago, and that is an integrity fee. He wants a million-dollar question.
You know, and that's the only way you get a piece of the action. It has to be legislated in to force all these books to contribute to this integrity fee, and then everybody gets
to the tune of billions of dollars. Shouldn't they get something?
You know what? This is kind of in a much smaller scale, Simmer, that this is the NHL and the Olympics. Listen, we're shutting our league down, and we're sending out, it's all our labor and it's all our product here. Can we not get a better deal here? Can we get something out of this? And can we play the highlight for the golden goal for Sidney Crosby, at least, to give us something?
But and also when you involve gambling like anything else, you have to have integrity in place, and that's a lot harder than people realize. And to that point, Eric, and it's as simple as a 50-50, which is now available on your TV. I'll use the Ottawa Senators as an example. We have to at some point here think that if you want to be progressive in doing this, that you would involve your broadcast partners. They would be part of the betting going on in TV for a few reasons. First of all, it's increased revenue for your TV partners. It brings more eyes onto the game and watching because people are betting on it. And then that's where all of a sudden the broadcaster to the teams, to everybody else, could end up sharing in some of that revenue. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, gambling presents the timing of legalization and gambling effectively provides a good opportunity for leagues when they need it. And what I say is that, adults in the ages of 18 and 35 are not watching sports like they did 20 years ago. And on top of that, the audience has become so fragmented. You've got people taking in content across all kinds of platforms. No longer, when we grew up, certainly we had three channels. You know, or maybe three U.S. networks and maybe CBC and CTV here, and that's
it. Yeah, not much.
You know, but now, if you're watching an NFL game and it's kind of going slow, you'll flip on Netflix and never go back to the game. And so it presents an opportunity. You know, but with respect to this issue, the broader issue of integrity generally, the reason we have a commissioner in sports, we have commissioners, is because of the Black Sox scandal back in 1919, where the Sox ironically threw the World Series to the Reds of all teams by betting against themselves. That resulted in public confidence being so undermined in the game that the owners went and found this federal retired judge, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, and said, will you be our commissioner? He was very crabby, really annoyed, and he said, I'll do it, but leave me the hell alone. Of course, that role commissioner has changed now. The commissioner works for the owners. But back then, he was this neutral kind of figure, and his mandate was to secure the integrity of the game. We have to be careful. You have to be careful with gambling. If it's so widespread and on your phones, particularly with all these prop bets, you have to be careful that and appreciate that there remains a risk, perhaps a heightened risk, given the accessibility of the ability to bet on games, a heightened risk that the games can be compromised.
There is two components to your show, business and law. Let's go business here. Last train of thought for you this morning. Breaking news from the Globe and Mail this morning that the Blue Jays have a plan in place. Well, a couple of plans. Number one, what they'd like to do is just tear down to the foundations, Rogers Center, and rebuild on the site on a smaller footprint for the actual stadium and add some condos and what have you at the one end. And failing that, a backup plan to do something lakefront here. But so looked it up here. 1989, it opens up. It costs $570 million at the time to build then SkyDome, largely picked up by the taxpayers. Now, and they bought it, they being Rogers, for $25 million as part of their deal a number of years ago. This will be a privately funded deal. There will not be taxpayer money, but of course they need all kinds of different government approvals here. What is your take on the Blue Jays going down this road to get a new stadium?
Typically, the lifespan of a stadium is 25 years. So that, you said it was 89, so that's 31 years. So I think they're due for a new stadium, number one. Number two, if you ever watched a game there, it's like watching a game inside an office building. It's a terrible, terrible place to watch a game. But I think more importantly, at the time, it was innovative. When Richard Petty, the CEO of MLSE, built it, it was this huge accomplishment. But now, 30 years later, it's time for something else. And I think in a city like Toronto, they're not going to have any issues getting a new ballpark built on that piece of land. I think it makes good sense, Simmer, because I think that the fan experience was compromised there. And also, bottom line is, it's an old building.
Yeah, I just wonder, Eric, and we talked about it earlier, is first of all, how is the CNE controlled as far as the land there? Is that like the NCC? But also, if you go back to, and I started going there early 90s, there was nothing there. And then all of a sudden that came, but I think it was really the ACC and the train yards where all of a sudden the residential, that plot of land, whoever controls that at the end of the day, certainly valuable to have a baseball team, but at the same time, the land value must be just off the charts now as far as flipping that and then going down to the lakefront if you could.
Totally. You know, I think that I think one of the selling points is going to be we can build a smaller facility and allow for more residential and business units around that new stadium. And on top of that, having, you know, the hockey rink and having BMO Field and having this new ballpark, having all that downtown just makes downtown Toronto far more attractive. And it certainly promotes Toronto on television when people are watching games in other cities. I think it's a win-win, especially in this type of situation and given the strength of the Toronto economy.
And to that point, and you kind of stole a little bit of it, but hey, as you just pointed out, sports venues and sports arenas bring a lot of value both in commercial and private real estate, right? I mean, having a sports arena, look at Kanata. I mean, people may complain about the rink, but I don't think we'd even have a Stittsville had they not put in the we built in a war zone in DC in the mid 90s, like a war zone. You go back there now, Eric, go anywhere in the world where these sports venues are put, for the most part, a lot of positivity comes with them.
Oh my goodness, I remember going to Washington before they built Verizon, and that's where the Capitals play, and that entire area was as unsafe as most of Washington, which was pretty unsafe. Like, you could not walk beyond 4 or 5 meters left or right without being afraid of, like, getting shot at. I mean, I'm not making fun of it.
And that's only two blocks from Pennsylvania Avenue in the Capitol. Right?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It was super close. Yeah. Now, go to where Verizon is, where the arena is, and it's astonishing.
Yeah.
It's literally a transformation. And if you do it right, this whole notion about building a stadium far out, really like the Expos did, building the stadium near PNF, I mean, it was just a disaster. But if you situate it properly and strategically, it can have a tremendous benefit for the growth of your city long term.
Building stadiums and not getting government money involved, it's kind of like how a lot of golf courses get built. It's not about the actual course or the stadium. It's about the value around it. What are you going to sell around it, the condos, the office buildings, and what have you. So we'll see what happens with the Jays, but that's encouraging news if you're a Jays fan. Maybe have a brand new facility, as Simmer and I mentioned off the top of this conversation when it broke earlier this morning, Eric. It was quite the project, right? Remember when it opened and it was very impressive, but immediately was obsolete. Camden Yards came along, Jacobs Field came along, and let's go natural grass, let's get away from this kind of thing. It was a dinosaur quickly, wasn't it, right? So it'd be nice to have a grass field, open air, maybe retractable that way for the fans in Toronto.
Yeah, I took my boys a couple years ago to their first baseball game, or at least their first Major League Baseball game. We had gone to see the Pelicans play the Cubs single A team. That was in Myrtle Beach or in South Carolina. But I took them to a Jays game, Jays Yankees, and I felt like I needed to apologize to them because this was not perhaps the most ideal first Major League Baseball game, as I felt like they're playing this game inside of a high rise. So yeah, Steve, it's time for a new stadium. Toronto needs something much better than that.
And that's the beauty of baseball, Eric. You go to Camden Yards, I'm not even a baseball fan, just being outside in a nice venue, it really doesn't matter what's happening. Final question for me, thoughts on an all-Canadian division in the National Hockey League and thoughts on what has been a real good offseason for your Montreal Canadiens?
Oh, well, as far as an all-Canadian division, I'm fine with it for this season because I never anticipated more than a 48-game schedule. I think the league is going to start in mid-February because the NHL will only get certain financial concessions, not all they're asking for, so it's not in their interest to play a longer season because they'll lose more money. So based upon that, I'm fine with an all-Canadian division because they won't be playing each other maybe more than four times. I don't know what it's going to be. As far as the Montreal Canadiens, my goodness, so many great moves. Toffoli, Anderson, Jake Allen, Edmonton. I don't know if I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure Marc Bergevin won the Employee of the Month for the Montreal Canadiens. And finally, the Canadiens have gone from squarely a non-playoff team squarely a playoff team, which is great.
Question for you as well, following up on the Canadian division versus the American. Distribution of the vaccine could have a huge effect as we get into the spring. I know there's people in the United States expecting to get the vaccine in December. What if all of a sudden your partners to the south are actually getting fans in the building and you're sitting here empty? I guess you go into a whole lot more profit sharing?
I would think so, yeah. And I think that's the expectation, right? We're not going to get a vaccine here, I guess, until April, probably.
Well, they forgot to order it. They thought they didn't get the confirmation number. I know there's been a lot going on, and Trudeau's at his cottage all the time. But like, seriously,
I'm pretty sure that Amazon dropped off 50 million vials on my doorstep, but then someone swapped them out. So it's going to be sort of a long call for us here. I don't anticipate us being vaccinated until late summer or the fall, which is interesting. You'll see if there'll be a black market for that kind of stuff, but I guess we'll see.
All right. Well, you get that update going, okay? You got to update the show coming up for the weekend, and you got to go throw down doing some Black Friday shopping, I'm sure. So we'll let you go. Thank you, Eric.
Can I just replay this segment? Okay. Thanks, guys. Take care.
All right. Eric Markermella on the Gabriel Pizza Hotline. Download the Gabriel Pizza app and start earning those pizza perks today.